60 Minutes, coming up next.
Now, people used to think you needed a lot of money to market your business, but that was before Vistaprint.com came along. You see, they've got everything you need to get the word out about your product and services, and you don't have to spend an arm and a leg. In fact, right now, for a limited time, they're offering 250 premium business cards for just $10, and that $10 includes shipping. That's a great deal. And if you ever need to order more cards, they have quantities up to 5,000, so they can handle everything. Don't worry, it's okay if you don't have a large marketing budget to spend on cards and such. Vistaprint is very affordable and allows you to order their quality cards at the low everyday prices all the time. In fact, they have a low price guarantee for their premium business cards. So if you're ever not happy, they're not happy. You just call them up and they'll make it right. And right now, to get 250 premium business cards for $10, which includes shipping, just go to Vistaprint.com and put the promotional code 60 into the cart. So don't delay. Order your 250 high-quality premium business cards for just $10 today and get your shipping included. Just go to Vistaprint.com and put in promotional code 60 in the cart to get this offer.
On this Palm Sunday, 60 Minutes introduces you to Pope Francis through some of his closest friends. From the woman whose children he baptized and calls every birthday.
I knew that he would phone me, but I didn't expect that he phoned me so quick.
To this man.
You are the Pope's rabbi.
Let us say so.
Rabbi Abraham Skorka has been a close friend of the Jesuits since he was an archbishop in Argentina.
I knew him very, very well, that he's a revolutionary.
We'll talk to President Obama about whether this revolutionary is influencing his politics.
Buonasera.
And we'll hear how seriously the Pope takes his position as successor to St. Peter.
When he met one day people from Jesuit school, and there was a little girl that asked him, did you want to be a Pope? And he said, you have to be crazy to want to be a Pope.
There hasn't been an American winner of the Boston Marathon in almost 30 years. But at next week's race, all eyes in the city will be watching this woman.
It's my ultimate dream and goal to win the Boston Marathon. I am all in with this training.
Shalane Flanagan is an American, but more importantly, she's a Bostonian and a world-class runner who was the very first person to sign up for next week's marathon after last year's deadly attack.
I'm Steve Croft.
I'm Leslie Stahl.
I'm Morley Safer.
I'm Bob Simon.
I'm Anderson Cooper.
I'm Scott Pelley. Those stories tonight on 60 Minutes. You can tell a lot about a man by how he signs his name. Popes have a special way. The name followed by PP, short for Papa, and the appropriate Roman numeral. So imagine the surprise around the Vatican print shop when the new pope started signing things Francis, just Francis. Humility has made the former Jorge Bergoglio a star far beyond the Catholic Church. But don't mistake humility for weakness. Just plain Francis is also being signed on orders to transform institutions fossilized by tradition and stained by corruption. For Palm Sunday, we thought you'd like to hear from some of the people who know Francis best, but don't ask them what he's going to do next, because God only knows.
In St. Peter's Square, March 2013, 100,000 faithful waited for a light to split the curtain. They'd adjusted their eyes to what they were accustomed to seeing, regal robes and a gold cross around the neck of a European. Instead, they saw an emissary from the new world with a world of new ideas.
He was just dressed so simply. There was no cape, there was no fur, there was no... And he was just standing there, and in a simple silver cross, evidently the one that he wore when he was in Buenos Aires.
Robert Mickens was among the believers in disbelief. He's an American journalist covering the Vatican.
And then he started by saying,
Buonasera.
Buonasera. Good evening. Popes don't do that. They say, Laudator Jesus Christus or something like that. But the biggest thing was when he asked the people on the square to pray over him. Everybody keeps saying, pray for me. That's not what he said. He said, let's pause for your prayer over me. That's a blessing. And he put his head down. You could have heard a pin drop.
For Francis and the Vatican, that was the last quiet moment. Since then, the halls of St. Peter's have been ringing with commands. Insiders out, outsiders in. Priests ordered from their cathedrals and into the streets. For Pope number 266, there are a lot of firsts.
Nobody's ever taken the name Francis. I mean, that's an extremely challenging program just in the name.
What did it mean to the church?
He took the name Francis from Francis of Assisi, who is probably the most beloved saint, among Catholics and especially non-Catholics. And, you know, had this great love for the poor, God's creation, nature, peace. And what we've seen is that he lives very radically, very simply, rather than some monarch, prince, or king, or monarch, pope.
His most radical decision came on his second day. He toured his 16th century palace looking like a home buyer whose realtor just didn't get it. In here, he'd be kept behind a barrier of minders and schedulers. So he chose freedom in a Vatican hotel where he lives and dines with everyone else. His room 201 is a key to the world. This leader of a billion Catholics demands to be in touch.
I knew that he would phone me, but I didn't expect that he phoned me so quick.
He phoned Elisabetta Piquet 12 hours after his election. She's an old friend, an Argentinian journalist, and her children were baptized by Bergoglio.
2 days later was my birthday, and he phoned again. But in that sense, we have here the scandal of normality, because he's a normal man.
The scandal of normality.
Scandalous, checking out of a hotel, posing for a papal selfie, and standing in the rain.
We see this scandal almost every day. 10 days ago, when he went for a retreat, he wanted to go in the bus like the others, and he didn't want to go by helicopter or in his own car. This is why people love him, I think.
They loved him in a simple car in July, but it was frightening when Brazil's 130 million Catholics seemed to show up all at once. Francis responded by rolling down the window.
A lot of people was afraid. He asked, especially, that he didn't want so much security. And he explained it very well. If I go to visit you to your house, do I go with in a box, a glass box? No. If I go to your house to visit you, I want to be with you, near you, and I want to touch you. And he said, I know that someone, there always can be a crazy one that would do something, but I prefer this craziness, to have this risk that there would be a barrier between me and the people.
That's physical courage. In the tradition of the Pope's religious order, the Jesuits, who call themselves soldiers of God. These days, Jesuits are also known for intellectual courage, battling over ideas.
I knew him very, very well, that he's a revolutionary. He is not a person who likes to go in the middle way. No, in the extremes.
To know the leader of the Catholic world, it's helpful to talk to a rabbi. Abraham Skorka of Argentina is an old, close friend.
You are the Pope's rabbi.
Let us say so.
They met while debating one of the greatest of all human conflicts, Argentinian soccer. Skorka's team often chokes in the clutch, so the fans have a nickname.
We received the name of chickens.
What? The chickens?
The chickens. Why? Not the lion, not the tiger, but the chicken.
Francis is a card-carrying member of a rival team. This is his actual membership card. His Holiness couldn't resist temptation, though, when he said this to Skorka.
I guess that this year we are going to eat chicken soup. Oh, I received that as an aggression, as a really aggression. But I understood that behind the joke was a message. Look, we can joke together. We can speak on the same level.
Las manos de Dios se comprometió.
They did speak on the level in a TV series and a book they wrote together. After all, pontiff is Latin for bridge builder.
You learned that there could be conversation, common ground among the faiths.
Yes.
But soccer, no.
No. Never.
Jorge Bergoglio took his vows to heaven as Argentina went to hell. In the 1970s, many thousands vanished in the dictatorship's mill of torture and death. Bergoglio helped hide opponents of the government. Still, Rabbi Skorka told us that Francis is troubled, like many in his generation, over whether he could have done more.
The Pope keeps telling everyone who will listen that he is a sinner, chief among sinners. Why does he say that?
Because he is showing a way. One of the great sins of the leaders throughout the world is that they used to appear before their people as perfect persons and perfect leaders. He is teaching what a real leader must be.
We saw that lesson when the Pope met an Argentinian adversary. President Cristina Kirchner once called him medieval for opposing her plan for gay adoption and same-sex marriage. Watch what happens. She'll touch him and recoil, thinking it's not allowed. See how he reacts. It seems Francis has kissed the past goodbye.
To my eye, when you see photographs of Bergoglio as Archbishop in Buenos Aires, he looks like he has the weight of the world on his shoulders. He looks like a man who is tired. And now you see pictures of him as Pope, when he does have the weight of the world on his shoulders, and he is smiling and light. Help me understand that.
He understood very, very well that his image must be an image of hope.
Well, he understood how important it was that a tired old man didn't shuffle out onto that balcony.
Yes, that's so he changed.
He's changing many things, including the ancient ritual of washing feet on Holy Thursday, as Jesus did with his disciples. With popes, they're almost always the feet of priests. But Francis cleansed and kissed teenagers in a criminal detention center. Two were women, unheard of, and two in the group were Muslim. When traditions like that wash away so easily, people begin to talk. And there are some incredible Francis stories. There's the one about the Pope sneaking out of the Vatican at night behind the wheel of a beat-up old car to minister to the poor in Rome, and the one about him driving the same car to the airport to pick up an old friend. The trouble is, those stories and all of their variations, not true. The people who work closely with the Pope tell us that what he does do is pick up the phone and call a lot of people. It's a desk phone, not a cell phone. His emails and tweets, we're told, are sent by the staff.
Did he want to be Pope, in your estimation?
Well, he himself, when he met one day the people from Jesuit school, and there was a little girl that asked him, did you want to be a Pope? And he said, you have to be crazy to want to be a Pope.
It is all-consuming. At 77, he rises to every public audience, the blind, the deaf, the poor, the sick, the dying. Crazy, or maybe just an old Jesuit soldier embracing his final orders. When we come back, we'll talk to President Obama about his conversation with the Pope in Rome, and we'll look at what Francis did last Friday that no Pope has ever done before. Last Friday, Pope Francis was reading a prepared script about children and families when he stopped and did something that no pope has ever done. Off the cuff, he took personal responsibility for the rape and abuse of children by priests. He said, quote, I feel compelled to personally take on all the evil, to personally ask for forgiveness for the damage done. It was another advance from a pope of firsts, first from the Americas, first Jesuit. Before Francis was elected, many expected the cardinals to select a younger man for the job because the sins of the church were so great. But after a year, it appears the 77-year-old Francis may be equal to the task.
What did he inherit in the Vatican?
Oh, he inherited a mess.
Robert Mickens is an American journalist who's been covering the Vatican for more than 25 years.
He came in at a time when there was great scandal. There were documents being leaked in the press about financial corruption, cronyism. There were even some sexual misconduct that was in these documents that were leaked. So he had a very clear mandate from the cardinals that elected him, clean up the house.
He's cleaning with committees of cardinals and lay people, investigating sex abuse, the Vatican Bank, and reform of the ancient bureaucracy of the church itself, starting with the executive offices at headquarters, known as the Roman Curia, Latin for court.
He set up a council, a privy council of eight cardinals from around the world to advise him on reforming the Curia and governing the universal church. Really? Governing the universal church. Most people overlooked that. They thought he was going to come in and clean up the Vatican and reform the Roman Curia. Instead, what Francis has embarked upon is a reform of the governing structure of the church.
And the church that he dreams of looks like what?
A missionary church. A missionary church that shows the mercy of God. A church that's not wagging its finger at people, not scolding people, but is inviting people, walking with people, befriending people. He uses the word synodal, synod. Synod means walking with. That's not just for the church, but it's for all humanity. He's called the church a field hospital after a battle.
The battlefield wounded that Francis speaks of are Catholics harmed by the church and the wider world of the dispossessed. He said this about the media and public attention.
Questo passa oggi.
This is what gets through today. If investments in the banks and elsewhere drop a little, oh, tragedy, what can we do? But if people die of hunger, if they're sick, no, none of that gets through.
Questa è la nostra crisi di oggi.
We're a sleeping giant. We are. The church is a sleeping giant.
To understand Francis, we went to one of the people he handpicked. The career of Gerald Lacroix of Quebec City is similar to the Pope's, leading through the slums of Latin America. The Pope has faith in Lacroix, and so made him one of his first new cardinals, although Francis didn't mention that to Lacroix before the announcement.
Most of the time, I guess, from what I've heard, one or two or three days ahead of time, they get a heads up, you know, get ready, the Pope will announce such and such a day. But this time, Francis decided to do things differently.
He seems to decide to do a lot of things differently.
Yeah, yeah. And it's challenging, but it's wonderful. It keeps us on our toes.
Lacroix found out about his elevation in a divine message written on a tablet. His iPad woke him, dinging with notes of congratulations. Later, he got a letter from the Pope.
The letter said this. Now, you being named a cardinal, Gerald, is not a promotion, it's not an honor, and it's not a decoration. It is a call to widen your spirit and a call to serve.
The Pope has graced the covers of many magazines. There's even a magazine dedicated just to him now. But he has described all of this attention as, quote, offensive. Why do you think so?
I think maybe it's in a way to tell us it's not about me. Of course he's very popular. He's very attractive. He's such a joyful man. That in itself makes him a star. But what he's telling us down deep is, it's not about me. Turn to the Lord.
And turn to the people. One of the first things Francis asked Lacroix to do was administer a questionnaire to the parishes. The Pope wanted to know what people thought about same-sex marriage, contraception, and divorce.
We need to look at reality. We need to look where people are at. And we need to look at the gospel and the teaching of our church and see how we can help people from where they're at to grow.
You are abundantly aware of the urgent concerns that many Catholics have about the sex abuse scandals, about financial scandals at the Vatican, about the role of women in the church. What are we going to see, in your estimation, from this Pope on those very important matters?
Just mentioning the sex scandal, excuse me, always touches me. Because of lack of coherence and because of sin, so many people have been hurt in the United States, in Canada, in many other parts of the world, and that is absolutely scandalous and acceptable. You talked about difficulties in economics and in the way we handle money, properties. He was, right from day one, very, very involved in making sure that those things change.
Perché le lobby tutti non sono.
The Pope surprised people in a news conference when he said, if someone is gay and searching for the Lord and has goodwill, then who am I to judge him?
Chi sono io per giudicarla?
The Pope has written that the Church has a false sense of security with, quote, rules that make us harsh judges. He asked, whom are we going to evangelize if this is the way we act?
This upsets a lot of very conservative Catholics because he's the one supposed to judge. You know, what he has done is he's opened up discussion in the Church. There has been no discussion on issues like birth control, about premarital sex, about divorced and remarried Catholics receiving the same. None whatsoever. There's been no discussion for the last probably 35 years on that. He's getting them to speak about it. Over the next 2 years, the Pope says, if there's opposition, if there people disagree, that's not a problem. We want discussion. That's something very, very new.
But on a couple of old controversies, Francis has closed discussion. Opposition to abortion will remain firm. He says the right to life is linked to every other human right, and the priesthood will remain male.
What are Francis's limitations?
He's got to do some more with women, because they are more than half the church, and they are the ones that are effectively keeping the church, you know, up and running. But they are not at the heart of decision-making.
Francis's roadmap for the church is the first thing he wrote as Pope, called The Joy of the Gospel, emphasis on joy. He writes, an evangelizer must never look like someone who's just come back from a funeral.
Does he get a perverse pleasure out of tweaking all the protocols of the Vatican and breaking all the rules?
I wonder. I mean, I do. I think a lot of us do. He's just being himself. I remember about a month into the pontificate, a priest friend of his from Buenos Aires gave an interview and said, you know, I talked to him on the phone and I said to him, Jorge, is this not a problem that you're not living in the palace, that you're not wearing the red shoes? And he said to me, Pepe, if I did that, I'd look ridiculous. That's not me.
Truth is, the Pope loves a joke and His Holiness has a devilish wit. You can see it in his eyes after the gotcha punchline. And the mightier the audience, the sweeter the punch. 2 weeks ago, after meeting the Pope for the first time, President Obama spoke with us at the U.S. Ambassador's residence in Rome. He told us that Francis joked that for two men of great power, it was really young people who ordered them around.
Can you give me a sense of what it's like to be in the presence of Pope Francis?
He's a wonderful man. He projects the kind of humility and kindness that is consistent with my understanding, at least, of Jesus' teachings, his simplicity and his belief in the power of the spiritual over the material reflects itself in everything that he says and does. And I suspect, my sense is that he's a little bit uncomfortable with all the trappings of being Pope.
Embarrassed by them?
Well, you know, that's not his style. And that is part of why I think he has been so embraced around the world, because people get a sense that first and foremost he sees himself as a priest and as a disciple of Christ and as somebody who is concerned with, you know, the least of these.
What did the Pope say to you in that meeting that inspired you?
We spent a bulk of our conversation around issues of poverty and inequality, themes that he's been talking about quite a bit, and obviously issues that I care about deeply. The very poor finding fewer and fewer ladders to get into the middle class, youth unemployment high. You know, these are chronic problems. What the Pope's able to do in a way that no politician to do is to shake people's conscience and to shine a light on the problem. It's our job to come up with policies to do something. What the Pope can do is to help mobilize public opinion.
But how practical is that? Stalin once said of the power of the papacy, how many divisions does the Pope have?
I'm a big believer in the power of conscience, the power of faith, the power of a message of hope. I think over time that's what moves history. Tanks and divisions and dollars and cents, you know, all those things obviously make a difference. But ideas are the most powerful thing on earth.
The power of the papacy comes laden with 8 official titles. They start with the Grand, Bishop of Rome, Vicar of Christ, etc., etc. But the last is the most modest, Servant of the Servants of God. Maybe in titles, Francis looks to the book of Matthew. Let the last be the first.
One man in one little tiny place in the center of the city of Rome can't do everything, and no one should expect him to. But he is there as an icon, as the captain of the ship, in a sense. And now it's, you know, it's up to the rest of the church to get with this very challenging program. And any Christian that's not challenged, wherever you are, right, left, center, conservative, progressive, if you're not challenged by Pope Francis, as one of my colleagues recently said, you're not listening.
60 Minutes, coming up after this short break.
So I was recently looking to buy a new car, and I thought to myself, there has to be a better way. And that's when a friend of mine told me about this new way to buy a car. It's called TrueCar.com. At TrueCar.com, you can actually see what others paid for the car that you're looking at in your area, so you know if you're getting a good price. Because here's what happens. At TrueCar.com, you get a savings certificate, and you just take your savings certificate to a TrueCar certified dealer. You can't beat it. Save time, save money, never overpay. If you're going to buy a car, go to TrueCar.com today.
Eight days from now, a million people are expected to line the streets of Boston to watch 36,000 runners compete in the world's oldest and most prestigious marathon. The memory of the bombings near the finish line of last year's Boston Marathon is still fresh. And next week, the race promises to be unlike any other in its 117-year history, a chance for the city to come together and reclaim a beloved tradition that was torn apart by an act of terror. There hasn't been an American winner, male or female, of the Boston Marathon in almost 30 years. Kenyan and Ethiopian runners now dominate the sport. But this year, an American woman named Shalane Flanagan has a very real chance of winning the 26-mile race. She's only 5'4" and 102 pounds, but don't be fooled. She's been called a ponytailed assassin in knee socks. She also happens to have grown up in Boston, which makes her next week's hometown favorite.
Maybe it's just a Bostonian thing, but I was really genuinely just pissed off that someone would ruin such a celebratory day and a historical moment with that kind of action.
You were angry.
So I was angry. I was really pissed off that that someone would do this. It's like it was a personal attack to my city.
Shalane Flanagan has been running in her city since she was a teenager. She grew up in Marblehead, a nearby suburb, and though she lives in Portland, Oregon now, she frequently returns to Boston to train along the marathon route.
It's my ultimate dream and goal to win the Boston Marathon. I am all in with this training. I have been out on the course training on it multiple times this fall, and I know almost every divot and bump in the road.
The Boston Marathon has been a part of Shalane Flanagan's life since she was a child. Both her parents were marathon runners. Her father ran 11 minutes off world record pace at the Boston Marathon in 1980. Her mother set a women's world marathon record in 1971.
I thought everyone's parents ran. I thought everyone got up and went to the, you know, Sunday long run.
You thought everybody's parents
did
that?
Yeah, I thought it was like Church of Sunday long run.
Everyone, Church of Sunday long run.
That's what my dad would call it.
Long before she ever thought of running the Boston Marathon, Shalane used to stand near the finish line of the race to cheer her father on.
I watched from Hereford all the way down to the finish, and that's exactly the two areas where the bombs went off. So it was a surreal moment to think of. That was, I was a little kid watching my dad run right there. I mean, that easily could have been me or my sister.
When the bombs exploded last year, three people were killed. 264 others were injured. The youngest victim was 8-year-old Martin Richard.
To see the young bodies lying there on Boylston Street, it's something that I'll never get out of my mind.
William Evans is the new Boston Police Commissioner. He's also a competitive runner. Last year's marathon was the 18th he'd run in Boston.
To have just come down that street an hour earlier with such excitement, such joy, and then to return again, I just didn't believe that could happen on Boylston Street in the city of Boston.
Commissioner Evans wanted to run again this year, but decided he should stay in the command post to oversee security.
You're going to see 36,000 people on that course with the same principle. And let's prove that we won't be intimidated by what happened back in April.
The race this year for a great many people will be about that. It will be seen as a response to terror, as a statement of resilience.
Tom Grillick is the executive director of the Boston Athletic Association, which has organized the marathon throughout its long history.
The event will go forward as what it has always been, both an athletic competition focused on excellence and a celebration around here of a great event in our community.
This year, he believes more spectators than ever will be on the streets cheering on the runners.
They want to take part.
They want to take part. If you're out there as a spectator and somebody comes along and their T-shirt says Carly on it, 1,000 people along the way will say, "Go, Carly!" And everybody will have a good time.
Carly will suddenly have thousands of new friends.
Carly will look wicked happy.
Most runners in next week's marathon will just be happy to finish or reach a personal best. But for Shalane Flanagan and the other top runners, the goal is winning. The race is as much about strategy and psychology as it is physical conditioning.
Obviously, marathons are painful, but for you, it's about being able to deal with pain yourself and also inflict pain on others.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of strategy.
Yes. You know, when I start to feel fairly uncomfortable, it's all about embracing it and realizing it's inevitable. Embracing it, yes. So if I'm uncomfortable, I usually know my competitors are uncomfortable. If they're straggling behind, that's kind of the time when I say, I'm going to put the screw in. I can tell that they're either struggling mentally or physically. So I'm going to just push it and just see if I can break them.
This is going to sound like an odd question, but do you like inflicting pain on your opponents?
I think everyone who's got a competitive bone in their body, to a certain degree, enjoy seeing a little bit some of the having their competition fall apart.
When Shalane started running in high school, there wasn't much strategy to her racing.
I would run so hard that I would literally make myself collapse.
I've heard you refer to it as kamikaze racing.
Yeah, I mean, it's
kamikazes don't end up very well.
I know. But sometimes it could be brilliant.
Shalane was a champion cross-country runner in college and won a bronze medal in the 10,000-meter race at the Beijing Olympics. But to compete in the marathon, she needed to learn a whole new way to run. In 2009, at the age of 28, Shalane moved to Portland, Oregon, and began working with coach Jerry Schumacher.
So we're going to two loops, which is a little over 24 miles.
And I'm prepping her to learn how to run 26 miles without blowing yourself up.
Which she had never done before.
Which, yeah, because she likes to go out and she likes to suffer. And in a marathon, if you're suffering at mile 3, you're probably not going to finish.
All right, good.
Running is Shalane's full-time job. She's sponsored by Nike, which allows her to focus solely on training for the Boston Marathon. She often runs twice a day, up to 120 miles a week. In addition to lifting weights, she has to rigorously monitor everything she eats. Food is fuel, but she doesn't want to gain any extra weight she'll have to carry in the marathon. Watching Shalane and other top marathoners compete, it's easy to forget just how fast and how far they're running. Last year's female winner of the Boston Marathon, Kenyan Rita Jeptu, closed her final mile at a pace of 4 minutes and 50 seconds. To finish a marathon running at 4 minutes and 50 seconds per mile, that's incredible.
It's incredible. After 25 miles of running, you have to be ready, even if it takes just that last mile, to do whatever. You got to do whatever it takes to get into that finish line.
Yeah.
To get a sense of just how fast Shalane runs during a marathon, we decided to try to keep up with her on a racetrack at Nike headquarters where she trains.
This is like a real race?
This is a real race.
Shalane would run a quarter mile at her marathon race pace, and I would run as fast as I could trying to stay with her.
So you're going to go for your marathon pace?
Yes.
And I'm going to...
We'll see if you like that pace or not.
Jerry started us off.
Ready, set, go!
I jumped out front at first, but within a few seconds, Shalane, with her even pace and easy flowing stride, blew right past me, laughing all the way. She completed the quarter mile in about 79 seconds.
Almost there!
Oh my God.
Keep in mind that to complete a marathon, you'd have to run that distance 104 more times.
Did you feel me suffering out there?
Oh, yeah. Because I... Did you hear those giggles? That was pure joy.
You were giggling, yes.
Shalane's first marathon was in 2010 in New York City. Remarkably, she came in second behind Kenyan Edna Kiplagat.
And it's Shalane Flanagan.
Completing the 26.2 miles in 2 hours and 28 minutes. It was the best finish by an American woman in New York in 20 years.
What did that tell you?
She can run the 26 miles. She can do the training for it. And in the right kind of race, she's going to be definitely dangerous.
Last year, Shalane ran the Boston Marathon for the first time. Early in the race, she and the other top women were running six-minute miles, a relatively slow pace. When Kenya's Rita Jeptu finally picked up the pace in the last few miles, Shalane's legs couldn't keep up.
Boston has this really fun way of trashing your quads. As much as you tell your legs to respond and to pop off the ground, and like as much as you want it spiritually and mentally, if your legs don't have it, they don't have it. You can't. There's nothing you can do. Like I try to talk to them, like, legs, you have to keep moving. You have to turn over. You need to be coming and giving me more energy. But if it's not there, it's not there. It's not much you can do.
You're actually talking to your legs.
Oh, yeah. I have talks with them. Yeah, I'll look at my quads. I'm like, come on, you can do this. And so, I mean, no one sees
that. Do they respond?
No, they're usually like, hey, screw you. You know, we've been running for a long time.
Shalane finished fourth. And after the bombings, was the first runner to sign up again to compete this year. For the past 12 months, she's been focused on this one race, memorizing the marathon route in Boston, running long distances in Portland, and running at high altitude in the mountains of Arizona. All of it, every mile, dedicated to returning to Boston in peak form and winning the marathon.
To you, winning the Boston Marathon would be bigger than winning an Olympic medal.
Yeah, you could say, here, Shalane, you have an Olympic medal, or you could win the Boston Marathon. A no-brainer to me would be winning the Boston Marathon.
Why?
It is personal. It's where my inspiration started. It's where I fell in love with running.
What would it mean if a local person, someone from Boston, won the women's race?
It would be super. It would. It would just signify how resilient this community is, and how hard someone would train to make sure this was special for everyone. So we'll go crazy.
The people who line the road certainly know any local runner who is there. So they will all know Shalane.
Do you think there are going to be a lot of people on the sidelines cheering for Shalane?
I think there will be a great many people on the sidelines cheering for
Shalane.
Go, Shalane, go, Marblehead.
She'll need all the support she can get. Last year's winner, Rita Jeptu, will also be running again next week.
Is Rita Jeptu beatable?
I believe so. Anyone is beatable. You know, Rita Jeptu is a phenomenal athlete, and I really admire her. But I know that on any given day, I can beat her.
Beating Rita Jeptu and her other opponents may come down to personal motivation, Shalane's anger and heartbreak over what happened in Boston last year.
It's probably not a day that goes by that I don't think about the events that unfolded there.
Did that add to your desire to run this year?
Absolutely. After what happened with the bombs and everything that unfolded, it just gave more meaning and more incentive to pour everything I have into winning it.
A few months ago, we accompanied Shalane on one of her final practice runs along the Boston Marathon course. Despite all her rigorous training, her constant study of the physiology and psychology of running, when it comes to the Boston Marathon, Shalane Flanagan isn't immune to a little superstition.
I don't cross it.
As many times as you've practiced in Boston leading up to this race, as many times as you've run on the actual course, you have yet to actually cross the finish line.
I've only crossed the finish line once.
Last year.
Last year.
During the race.
Yes, and I haven't done it in practice, no. So I'll save that for the day, for the real race.
Now an update on a story Morley Safer reported last week that we called Discovered. 2 years ago, German authorities uncovered the largest trove of missing art since the end of World War II. More than 1,400 works were crammed into the tiny Munich apartment of Cornelius Gurlitt, the son of one of Hitler's favorite art dealers.
Did you have any idea that he had so many paintings in that apartment?
I tell you what, nobody had any idea about this. Really? How can you live with 1,400 paintings in a flat, in a 90 square meter flat? I thought maybe he has 100 or 150, but 1,000. Everybody was surprised, you know.
Picasso was just the beginning. Cornelius Gurlitt's secret hoard of art included modern masters like Matisse, Chagall, Franz Marc, and Otto Dix.
The art, worth more than $1 billion, came from museums, Jewish-owned galleries, and collectors, some of it believed to be either looted or sold under Nazi duress. Although prosecutors seized the collection as part of a tax investigation, this week they agreed to return most of the works to Gurlitt, who, under Germany's 30-year statute of limitations, is their legal owner. Gurlitt, in turn, has agreed to return any art that proves to be stolen. I'm Leslie Stahl. We'll be back next week with another edition of 60 Minutes.